We'll get underway. It's great to see so many of you here this afternoon for our last Tuesdays with Ori presentation for the year. I was just having a look at the Tuesdays with Ori website, and there's quite a considerable list of talks and discussions that we've had as part of this seminar series since 2013, turning out to be a really valuable resource if people have got specific questions or want to find out about some of the most recent thinking in areas, lots of areas related to research ethics and integrity. It's a very good place to look. That's the advertorial done. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Andrew Ross to all of you, who's going to talk to us about taking advantage of disadvantage. When is international clinical research exploitative? Andrew's a recent graduate, I'm just reading to make sure I get it right, of the Queen's University at Kingston in Canada, for his dissertation on the same or similar topics. Andrew's been working with us in Ori since about the middle of the year on a range of projects, which he's not talking about today. It's all about the work he did during his PhD. So I'll hand over to Andrew. All yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Paul. As you can hear from my accent, I am from Canada. So just raise your hands if I get a little bit too thick of my accent and you don't know what I'm talking about. So today I'm talking about taking advantage of disadvantage, as it says, sort of exploitation in international clinical research. So I'll start out with some terminology and abbreviations that I'll try not to use too many abbreviations because there's a lot available and can get quite confusing, but I'll try to set out a few of the sort of ones that I know I won't be able to avoid at the start, so at least they'll make a little bit of sense. Then give a bit of background about exploitation and international clinical research sort of separately. Talk briefly about the guidance that we get on this topic from the National Statement, and then sort of, the pressing philosophical question of what is exploitation, and then the more applied question that sort of flows from that of what makes an international clinical trial exploitative. And I'm not going to give a firm answer on this, but rather sort of describe some of the positions that are out there, and then walk you through a couple of discussion cases, and hopefully that'll be a bit more of an interactive part of the session where we can sort of walk through a couple of examples and see what features of these examples might or might not make them potentially cases of exploitation. And then at the end, I've got some suggested readings for people who are interested. So terminology and abbreviations. The first one that I'm going to use because it's quite long to say is CRO, which is a contract research organization. This is a firm that exists solely for the purpose of conducting clinical trials that are actually sponsored by another firm. So this is not the drug company that actually invents the drugs and then later makes them and sells them. This is an outside firm that just does testing of the drugs, and they'll do testing for multiple different pharmaceutical companies. And so all they do is conduct trials. And these days a lot of clinical research is actually being outsourced to these kind of CROs from the pharmaceutical companies that actually invent the drugs. The FDA is the United States Food and Drug Administration. They are sort of the gatekeeper in a lot of ways in practical terms for commercial drugs because the U.S. drug market is so massive. It accounts for nearly half of all drugs sold are sold in America. If you can't sell your drug there, then you can't effectively make money on it. And so from a commercial perspective, the FDA is sort of, that's who you have to please, and everyone else sort of can follow along after that. So whatever rules the FDA sets down are the rules that pharmaceutical companies will make sure that they follow. Next, just a couple of short abbreviations about countries, high-income countries, HICs, and lower middle-income countries, LMICs. You could translate this as to your own preference as to whether you prefer sort of first world countries and third world countries or developing and developed countries. But basically, we're talking about the same groups of countries, and everyone sort of knows which ones fall into which category. But these are just sort of the terms that I've gone for. Outsourcing. This is, as a philosopher, I have to draw distinctions. Otherwise, they'll take away my card. So I'm drawing a distinction here between outsourcing and offshoring. So outsourcing is the process of delegating or subcontracting to another company. And so this is what happens when a pharmaceutical company hires a CRO to conduct a trial on their behalf. Then there's a separate process of offshoring, which is where you actually export the work from one country to another. And so in the process that we'll see shortly, both of these phenomena are sort of at play. So today's focus, as you might guess from the picture, is for-profit commercial drug trials. Specifically, I'm mostly going to be talking about what are known as phase three trials, and I'll talk about what that actually means in a minute. These are trials that are sponsored by pharmaceutical companies, which are all based in high-income countries. And the drugs in such trials that we're going to be talking about today are intended primarily for sale in high-income countries. In those markets, they're not aimed at the health priorities of low- and middle-income countries. But the trials are actually being conducted in low- and middle-income countries. And so people in those countries are the participants in these trials. So commercial clinical trials, the purpose of them is, from the commercial perspective, is to secure regulatory approval by demonstrating the safety and efficacy of an intervention, in this case a new drug, but the same can be said for interventions and vaccines, medical devices, that sort of thing. And the structure, there's sort of multiple phases, if you will, of trials. Well, not a just if you will, that's what they're called. Phase one is sort of first-in-humans trials, generally very small, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 80 people, and this is just testing to see if a drug is safe. So these are healthy volunteers, typically, and often are paid to participate because there's no chance of medical benefit for them. They're just testing to see, you know, what side effects might arise from taking the drug, but they don't actually have the condition that the drug is intended to treat. If it turns out to be reasonably safe at that level, then they move to a phase two trial, which is small-scale testing for still safety but also efficacy. So somewhere in the range of around 100 to 300 participants, and at this stage we're starting to get participants who actually might have the condition that the drug is intended to treat. And so we're starting to see testing for the whether the drug actually works or not yet at this stage. And then phase three, this is sort of the key phase, is the large-scale testing for efficacy and safety. And it's around 1,000 to 3,000 participants at this stage, roughly. And this stage is sort of key because if the trial shows the intervention at this level to be effective and safe, you can get regulatory approval, and you can actually start selling the drug. These trials are typically randomized and blinded. Essentially, that you will have sort of two or more arms of the trial, and the participants will be assigned either to the intervention being tested or to a comparison, whether that be a placebo, if there's no known treatment available for that condition, or to an existing treatment, if there is already one. Is that sort of clear enough so far? Any questions about clinical trials? No?
How many people
are
around in the phase three?
Phase three can be between 1,000 and 3,000. Those are very rough figures, and it depends a lot on a lot of different factors, but it's fairly large scale. There's quite a few people being involved at this stage. And then phase four, after the drug has already gotten regulatory approval, there can also be trials that are conducted to get finer grained information about side effects, or sometimes to see if it can be used to treat other conditions. But we're not going to worry about those ones too much today. And then at the same time as sort of running in parallel, I guess, with the the clinical trial is, from the commercial perspective, again, the patent process. So drug patents are intended to promote investment in drug development by making sure that the inventor firms actually can recoup their research costs, because it's very expensive to do drug research. And it's not actually, comparatively, it's not that expensive to actually make a drug. Once you already know that a compound is effective, the costs of actually producing that compound are quite low. And so if we didn't have drug patents, then the minute that a new substance was proven to be effective at treating something, every pharmaceutical company could start, you know, cranking out that drug, and it would, and be able to sell it, and it wouldn't, the price that would get charged for that because of the competition would be relatively low, and then the inventor firm wouldn't actually be able to recoup their costs. So how they work is the patents offer temporary protection against competition. So for the first 20 years, effectively, the inventor firm has an artificial monopoly. No one else is allowed to produce and sell that drug. And so they can charge far more than they could if other people were producing and selling the drug. And this is, you know, an intended feature. And this is why when patents expire, you start to get generics come out. And at the same time as generic coming out, the price of the sort of brand name drug also typically goes down quite a bit. But the important thing to keep in mind is that the patent clock, that 20 years, actually starts running as soon as the patent is issued. And that's not the same time as when the drug gets regulatory approval. The patent comes first and then the trials. And so it's very important to these firms that they get the trials done in as short amount of time as possible. And even sort of delays in terms of a couple of months can mean millions of dollars to these firms with a blockbuster drug. So they're very focused on keeping those trials as short as they possibly can, getting the results as quickly as they possibly can. And the other thing to keep in mind is that due to this treaty called TRIPS, very boring details, the upshot of which is that effectively drug patents are now basically global. So you get a drug patent, you get a patent for your drug in one country, and it's effectively every other country sort of observes that now. So even in sort of low and middle income countries where they're not necessarily inventing these drugs, maybe the patent isn't actually filed in, say, South Africa, which does have a sort of generic drug industry, the South African producers won't be able to start making generics until that 20 years has elapsed. So why worry about this? Sort of three big things going on in the background. One is this background of inequality between the high and middle income, the high income countries and the low and middle income countries. There's what's known as the 90-10 gap, where 90% of the money spent on drug research is spent on conditions that only account for 10% of morbidity and mortality in the world, and vice versa. So the remaining 10% of the funding is all that's spent on that other 90% of conditions. So it's obviously a very strong sort of commercially driven focus on profitable conditions, and specifically conditions where the people who have the condition have the money to pay for the new drugs. So there's a strong focus on any diseases that occur amongst well-off people in well-off countries. Those are the best researched in terms of new drugs. There's also a disparity in access to medicine and access to healthcare, obviously, between the high-income countries and the low- and middle-income countries. And so the concern that comes out of this is that we've got the people who are least likely to benefit from new drugs are the ones actually being asked to take the risks of participating in the trials when they're being offshored like this. Since the late 90s, pharmaceutical companies have increasingly been outsourcing their trials to CROs, and it's been estimated that around half of all commercial trials now are outsourced. And this just sort of compounds the sort of commercial agenda, because again, all the CROs do is this research, and they're paid on the basis of having of their reputation for getting these trials done and done quickly, and producing quality numbers. But they have some incentives to cut corners occasionally, because if they can produce the results quicker, that's the basis on which they get paid. And then this is sort of going on at the same time as this offshoring of research to low and middle income countries. And so over the same period, since the late 90s, these CROs are increasingly actually located in low and middle income countries. And so a lot of the research on new drugs, the actual trials, a lot of the time are taking place. At first, it was mostly in sort of Eastern Europe and former Soviet countries. And it's since shifted to a lot more focus more recently on India as sort of the main site where a lot of trials are being done. So there's different contexts for research between the two sort of types of countries, the high-income countries and the low- and middle-income countries. Research in high-income countries is well-regulated. You'll notice I put a little asterisk there. There's question marks about exactly how well-regulated it is, but comparatively speaking, it's well-regulated compared to in low- and middle-income countries. There's generally rules. There's, to some extent, enforcement of those rules. There's at least theoretical protections for participants. There's a separate discussion about how effective those protections are, but they at least exist in some extent. Again, in high-income countries, with an asterisk, people have access to regular health care. The main part of that asterisk, obviously, being America, where they don't actually necessarily have access to health care. But even in America, more people have access to regular health care than in, say, some of the poorer countries. Not everyone, but a lot of people have access. And again, in low- and middle-income countries, it's not necessarily the case. And this is a concern because, again, we're worried about the participants, and people who have no regular access to healthcare being asked to participate in a clinical trial, there's a concern that they maybe have additional motivation to participate in the trial just because, well, they may have misconceptions about the potential benefits of being in the trial, but also they actually get a chance to see a doctor and maybe get some ancillary care that they might not otherwise have access to. Again, a lot of asterisks in this list. So effective interventions are likely to become locally available in high-income countries. Effective with an asterisk because sometimes there's new drugs that aren't necessarily better so much as they've been able to show that they're better than nothing or they're not statistically worse than something else that's already out there. But again, at least what you know, they're becoming available locally after the trial is completed, whereas again, not so much the case in low and middle income countries. In addition to being locally available, interventions are likely to be accessible again with an asterisk in high income countries relative to in low and middle income countries. A lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people in high-income countries will be able to get these new drugs. They'll be able to actually afford them either through something like the PBS or through some sort of private insurance. Not everybody will have them, but certainly a lot of people will have access to them. They'll be able to afford them one way or another, whereas, again, not so much the case in low- and middle-income countries. So incentives for offshoring. There's a number of factors sort of driving this process. First is lower costs. Labor is cheaper in low- and middle-income countries. Real estate is cheaper. And it's the same reason that manufacturing gets offshored is why clinical trials are getting offshored. It's just cheaper to do it in poorer countries. From a clinical perspective, there's a benefit of plenty of treatment-naive potential participants because people who don't have access to regular health care aren't going to be taking a number of other drugs. And so from a purely clinical perspective, that's actually a major benefit because it's you get sort of cleaner numbers because you don't have to worry about interactions with other drugs that they might be taking because they won't be taking any. There's a reduced risk of negative publicity in the key markets, i.e. the markets where the drugs are actually intended to be sold. When if clinical trials have go badly, and there can sometimes be fallout in terms of PR, if there's bad side effects that are discovered, or if it's poorly run somehow, and that sort of gets out, then it's a lot of bad PR for the drug firm. If the trial actually happens in a lower middle income country, it's a lot less likely that they'll get that PR backlash in the countries where they're actually intending to sell the drugs and where most of their investors are located. And there's also the potential to get faster results due to candidates being eager to be recruited. It's a lot easier to meet your recruitment quotas when you're asking people who have no other option to see a doctor to say, hey, would you like to see a doctor? And then also we'll put you in this trial. And then also there's the issue of a sort of less red tape in the sense that a lot of these low and middle income countries have less than fully developed regulatory structures. And so there's a lot less requirements and paperwork to be done sometimes, which can again, lead to faster results, which is a major driver for the industry. So this is sort of the result of this outcome is, this might not be the first thing that pops in your mind when you see this picture, but that just shows that you're not a pharmaceutical company executive. Apologies if there's any in attendance, but I sort of doubt there are. So positive outcomes. We talked a lot about sort of the bad side of this, but there are definitely upsides. The first one is sort of obvious, if slightly counterintuitive, that this would be a positive, but the drug firms increase their profitability. And this is a positive in the sense that most of these companies are publicly owned. So this is good for people's super, for their investment portfolios if they have them. In other countries, there's different systems for sort of pensions that often rely on investment. And so this can be a good outcome. It's not bad necessarily. Just the fact that the drug firms are making more money is not in itself bad. It's actually in itself, let's say, good. But there's also the fact that some of these participants will get some amount of medical care, not with an asterisk relative to what they might have otherwise got, which in many cases might be nothing. And so this is, a positive outcome. It's not the best way for them to get access to medical care, clearly, but they're not getting it in any other way. So it's again, better than nothing. The CRO industry actually provides a lot of local economic benefits in these countries because, again, a lot of these firms are actually based in these low and middle income countries, and so they hire a lot of staff, and they're developing local research capacity as well. Local expertise, and obviously spending a lot of money locally and creating employment. And there's side benefits to these host countries as well, like infrastructure improvements and increased local research capacity that come along with these things. So if you're going to conduct a clinical trial, you need to have certain equipment, you need to have certain infrastructure in place, and in places where that doesn't exist, oftentimes firms will actually bring in that infrastructure or pay to have that infrastructure put in so that they can conduct the trials where the trial population is. So that can mean things like running water, electricity, so that they can run their fridge in their lab, because obviously you don't want to run that on a hand crank. And also patients in high-income countries can get quicker access to new treatments when these trials are because, again, the trials often can run more quickly in these settings, get quicker results. means they get regulatory approval more quickly and quicker access for people in the high-income countries who actually can't afford the drugs. They get them sooner than they would otherwise. And that's not a bad thing. And there's also the so-called trickle-down effect. So 20 years later, when the patents actually expire, then these new drugs do eventually become more accessible to people, to less well-off people in high-income countries, and also to people in middle-income countries, and to some extent, people even in low-income countries. But of course, there are problematic outcomes as well. So one problem is that it feels like we're sort of offshoring the risks of trial participation, but keeping most of the benefits of research, which doesn't feel particularly fair, I think, for most people. It doesn't necessarily sit that well with our sort of intuitions about fairness. And not only are we sort of giving other people the risks, but the participants in these countries actually bear the same risks as participants would if the trial were conducted in a high-income country, but actually have potentially less benefit individually because, again, at the conclusion of the trial, they're very unlikely to have continued access if the drug turns out to be effective. And the host countries also derive less benefit from the research than high-income countries that have no connection to the research. So let's say we conduct a trial in, say, Rwanda. The drug won't be available in Rwanda, or even if it is, no one there will be able to afford it. But people in Switzerland will get the drug, even if it was an American firm that did the research. The Swiss sort of get this benefit despite not having had anything to do with it. And the local host country where they actually, you know, sort of bore the burden, they get, you know, basically no benefit or very little benefit. So guidance. The National Statement does give us some guidance on this topic. Just quote here from there, which is that the distribution of burdens and benefits in research in overseas countries for participants and in some instances the broader community should be fair, and the research should not be exploitative. But this actually is not really that much it sounds like guidance, but it doesn't actually tell us anything because we need to know, well, what are actually the burdens and benefits of research? What actually would count as a fair distribution? Because we don't really know necessarily. Is it just whatever distribution that it occurs in high-income countries, or is it different? And if so, why? As well as when should the broader community benefit, and why should the broader community benefit? That's not necessarily clear, because the broader community isn't taking on the risks. The participants are taking on the risks. And so it's not clear when it would be appropriate for the broader community to expect benefits. And then, of course, the elephant in the room of what actually makes research exploitative. So it shouldn't be exploitative, but what would it mean for it to be exploitative? So to answer that, we have to look a bit at the theories of exploitation. And so there's sort of two main camps in this. The first camp views exploitation as just being unfairness. So avoiding exploitation then is a matter of ensuring that the distribution of benefits and burdens is fair to all parties. So we still have this question mark of, well, what actually is fair? But at least once we figure that out, then we know, well, as long as it's fair, it's not exploitation. And the second camp views exploitation as having to do with mere use. So avoiding exploitation isn't necessarily about the distribution of benefits and burdens, but it's about the way that we treat other human beings. And that avoiding exploitation then is about treating other people in a way that respects their inherent value and not using them as a as just a, an instrument for our own ends, for our own gain. So exploitation is unfairness. This is a bit of a quote, sorry, that A exploits B when party B receives an unfair level of benefits as a result of the interaction between B and A. And the fairness of the benefits that B receives depend on, first, the burdens that B bears as a result of the interaction. So the fairness of the benefits that a participant receives depends on the burdens that the participant bears as a result of, say, the clinical trial, and benefits that A and others, so the, let's say, the CRO, the sponsoring drug firm, other people in high-income countries who eventually will get access to the drug, the benefits that they receive also will factor into what amounts to a fair amount of benefits for B. And then that's just the source from this view. Apologies for the very, very long citation, but that's there's about 40 authors on that paper, which is why it's just participants is how it's usually cited, very confusingly. Exploitation is mere use, on the other hand. This is all the Kant fans in the room will recognize this one straight away. Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of another, always at the same time as an end and never simply as a means. This is just the categorical imperative. And so on this view, A exploits B. So let's say the CRO exploits the participant. When the CRO fails to respect that person's inherent value as a rational agent by using them with no regard for their interests and well-being. And so it's not just about who gets what, but about the way that people are treated. But in practice, like with most things in philosophy, these deep theoretical schisms actually don't add up to much in terms of actually in practice. Most of the time, both of these theories will pretty much lead us to the same conclusions about particular cases. But there's going to be different reasons that we come to those judgments. So what makes an international trial exploitative? One thought is that it could be about insufficient benefits to the participants, and either in terms of relative to their contribution or to the benefits that others receive, or to what would be sufficient to account as treating them as ends in themselves rather than just a means to our ends. Another thought is that maybe it has to do with not providing enough benefits to the host communities. And so some people complain that these outsourced trials, or sorry, offshore trials, are exploitative of not just the participants, but actually exploit the host communities by not providing enough benefits to them. It's also a question about not addressing local health priorities. So again, these trials are being conducted, you know, in order to develop or in order to prove the efficacy of money-making drugs. And those aren't necessarily the drugs that are really needed in the communities where the trials are actually being conducted. As we'll see in one of our discussion cases in a moment here. And then other factors. There's been a number of other sort of things have been suggested, and if you've got some other ideas, then we'd be happy to hear them in a minute, too, when we get to the discussion case. So the first discussion case, we'll say, pardon the alliteration, but Pharmaco, let's say this is a, as you may have guessed, an imaginary pharmaceutical company. Let's say they've developed a new drug to treat baldness, and they've hired a CRO in Dhaka in Bangladesh to conduct the clinical trials for this. The new drug, it's not going to be sold locally. There's just not a market. People don't have enough money to pay for this new drug. They've got other priorities. So they're not even going to bother to register it in Bangladesh if it turns out to work. But the participants will be paid a living wage in exchange for their participation. So there's going to be a clear benefit to the participants for participating. Not a medical benefit, but a benefit, and not insignificant one from their perspective. But again, they won't be given post-trial access to the drug, even if it does work. The pharmaceutical company obviously stands to profit a lot. They can make a lot of money off of that if it turns out to work. Other people might benefit, particularly in high-income countries. And so I'd like to throw this open to the floor about is this trial exploitative? And who is being exploited, if it is? How do we make it not exploitive? And if it is exploitive, why do you think it's exploitive? So just take a minute and sort of stew on that. But just a quick show of hands, though, first, maybe who thinks that this trial maybe is exploitive? Can I get hands up for yes, it's exploitive? Okay, quite a few. And then hands up for no, it's not exploitive? Okay, a couple. And hands up for I didn't put my hand up because I'm not sure? Okay, good. There's no right or wrong answers in philosophy, so not to worry. So those who thought that it was exploitive, did you think that it was exploiting who the local community? Maybe show of hands. A few, okay. Or was it exploiting the participants? A few more. Quite a few more. Is it John Howard that's being exploited, maybe? No? Okay, so if it's exploiting the participants, let's say, what is it about this trial that doesn't sit right with you? They could, yep, that's true. They do have, they do stand to lose.
One thing this doesn't show is what stage is the research? Is it being tested in patients?
I should have included that. Yeah, let's say that this is a phase 3 trial. So it's been, so they've done some safety studies. They found that it's relatively safe, and the phase 2 study was promising enough to make it worth their while to do a phase 3 study. So there's some evidence that it works. I mean, obviously, it's not a huge medical benefit in terms of hair regrowth. But
by the time you get to phase 3, it's not just evidence that it works. It's also evidence of safety.
Yeah.
So you've got a pretty good idea of most of the safety
profile. Yeah. So at this stage, it's not expected that it's going to be particularly dangerous to participate in this trial. If it was going to be very dangerous, it probably would have caught up already in phase 1 or 2. Does that fact change anyone's minds? The fact that it's probably not all that dangerous?
I would argue that the danger is only short term.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't know what is going to be other side effects. And this
sure.
is an innocuous drug. If you look at the effect, it's a cure for baldness, it's not life saving
mm-hmm.
in any way. So you would be concerned about long term outcomes as well, safety
mm-hmm.
outcomes as well. So it doesn't make me any happier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious about why they shouldn't, or why they decide not to sell it locally.
No? Basically, it's just a commercial decision. It costs money to go through the registration process, probably not that much,
yeah.
but
well,
it's time and money, they're not going to make any money in Bangladesh, they figure. At least not compared to what they'll make in
yeah.
high-income countries.
There is a commercial decision, but there is some ethics behind it also. You know, why because the people that already use, probably not too many, you know, they already use the pharmaco, probably will have to keep using it,
mm-hmm.
for example. And they're not going to get the chance to do it.
No.
And there is, again, as I said, I'm sure there is not a very profitable market there, that's right. But still, you know, you can, the money that you're probably going to spend or you would spend, you know, just putting then a Bible on the local. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't necessarily be that, you know, that much. You know?
No.
So I think there is an ethics behind it. Mm-hmm. Also, you know? So I think, and this is, well, and I agree, you know, this is not a case of life and death, you know, it's not cancer. Mm-hmm. You know? So, but anyway, I think that this ethics is not only in the research trials, it's also in the, even also in the commercial conduct.
Mm-hmm.
I have one question you haven't addressed. The flip side of this is paternalism,
mm-hmm.
and the view through the Western filter. Now, obviously in Bangladesh, there's a lot worse exploitation going on within culture.
Pretty safe assumption.
Same in India, where you've got a caste system. I wonder whether we are putting too much weight on what's exported in our eyes because we're looking at our culture as opposed to the freedom to make decisions based mm-hmm. on what they think is important.
So that actually raises another point that I haven't included here, but that I think is interesting to think about, is there's a notion that actually even an exploitive interaction can be mutually beneficial. So it's totally possible for these participants, say, to have been exploited, but even though they were exploited, they might still be better off than the baseline case where they had no interaction. So even a bad deal sometimes is better than no deal. If you'll pardon the very North American example, if your car is stuck in a snowbank and a snowplow comes by and offers to tow you out, but he knows he's the only one around and you're basically almost sort of captive to his demands, and he says, okay, well, I'll tow you out, it'll be $500. You might still take that offer, because even though you know you're getting ripped off, even though you know it's not a fair deal and he's taking advantage of your situation and under normal circumstances wouldn't charge anything near that, et cetera, at the end of the day, you're still probably better off than being stuck stranded in a snowbank in the middle of nowhere. It's not, just because something's exploitative doesn't mean that it's not better than the alternative of not having any interaction. So just something to think about. I mean, it varies quite widely. I mean, it's a massive industry, so it generally it's going to be similar to how participants might get selected by a contract research organization in a developed country as well, or in a high-income country as well. They may have connections with local clinics of doctors that they pay on a capitation basis for referrals. They might be advertising. They may have a pool of sort of human guinea pigs who are happy to take part in whatever phase one trials come up.
I don't have any medical background, but I can remember with the introduction of the contraceptive bill, seeing a documentary that drug companies to test it looked for a low-income country which had a very high birth rate. And from memory, they chose Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would not be exploited because the women would benefit from the lowering their birth rate as well as testing. So do you think they were doing the right thing?
Well, it's complicated because there's two things going on. They could be exploiting people, and it still might be better for those people that were being exploited than them not being exploited. So it's not black and white in that sense, that just because something's exploitive doesn't necessarily mean that it's worse than not doing that exploitive thing. And certainly it's worse than doing something else that would be, you know, also benefit the participant and not be exploitive of them, you know, but no one is proposing to do that other thing. And so,
they deliberately chose Cuba, mm-hmm. and it's close to the US, of course.
Yeah.
And it was a low income, and, you know, women were having 10 or 12 pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
Not healthy.
Yeah, well, and it may, all things considered, be a good decision, even if it turned, even if we might conclude that it was exploitive in a technical sense, we might still conclude that even despite that, overall, the harm of that exploitation might be outweighed by the benefit of the interaction.
But that's also taking a narrow view of the benefit, because you're assuming that the benefits are reduced number of pregnancies over a lifetime, but there could potentially be other risks that they're taking with the long-term use of drugs and long-term side effects of the drugs they wouldn't otherwise take. So, you know, you still go a way up. The, you know, the risks and the benefits and some of the potential risk of the benefits are completely unknown at the time of the study.
I guess the other question is, to what extent are participants in these countries really informed of potential risks and harms and benefits? Or do they think it's just a pure risk income which they might not otherwise have?
Yeah, I mean, there's that question definitely does get raised. I don't know that there's necessarily any sort of, sorry to throw around Latin, but again, philosopher, I can't help myself. There's not necessarily a prima facie reason, or at first glance, there's not necessarily a reason to think that participants in a lower middle income country will necessarily be worse informed than participants in a high income country, because there's actually quite a lot of evidence to suggest that participants in high income countries often don't actually understand what they've signed up for.
True, but literacy would be one.
Yeah, literacy would be one, but there's ways around that. If you did everything properly, if you actually, you know, had an oral consent process where things were clearly explained and done so in an accessible manner in the local language, then it's not necessarily the case that these people are signing up for something that that has not been explained to them as well as it would have been if they were in another country. So it's an issue that definitely exists, because in practice probably it's not particularly likely that these CROs are going to be setting best practice for consent, but it's not necessarily a factor in all the cases. If that makes sense.
And sometimes, I think it was in Africa, some developing countries, one are not interested in having the drug because of the expense or the usefulness of the drug. They are interested in getting, like, communities getting some other benefit, which might be, you know, a clinic or some money towards that. And, would be something they would think that is the benefit. And if wellness drug doesn't have long-term side effects, I mean, you don't need to
And that's another view that comes out in the literature is this idea that it's very important to actually consult early on with the local community to determine what they would count as being important benefits and what sort of benefits they think the community should receive in order for the community to agree to host the trial. And so it's sort of trying to address that paternalism concern that, well, if it's, you know, it's not necessarily paternalism, because we're actually consulting and getting their view on, you know, what they think would be fair. There's still a concern about, you know, they may have very limited view of how much money actually is in the balance for the drug company, just how much money the drug company stands to make if the drug works. And so, you know, they might be asking for far too little. There's certainly some people, at least, are making an effort to try to negotiate at the early stages, in the design stages even, to try to come up with some sort of balance here.
Because in a way, you know, like, I think this approach, I mean, just putting the attention on the on the particular trial, and not the more like extended relationship that the CRO produced, you know, or built with the communities or countries or whatever. You know? And actually, I think that like, may like shoot back, you know, in the long term, because if you don't build trust, you know, it would also like make people like less likely to, less interested to participate in a trial, you know, and this again would raise the costs in the long term, you know. So, and that's probably one of the reasons why it is actually less expensive to conduct these trials in less developed countries, you know, because you know there is less like publicity or bad publicity. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm probably getting too long, but I still remember when the first trial of the polio vaccine, you know, were I think it was in the 40s or 50s, something like that. That even, you know, number of families, you know, bringing the kids, you know, please, you know, try it, because this is like something for the humankind, you know. But now it's like, well, not with my kids, you know. So, and I wonder if there is that, if we're the focus we're using is too narrow, you know, not addressing all these other factors, which is more like a systemic interaction with the people, with the community, with the developing countries in this case, you know, or with the people that may be happy to help, you know, participate in the trial. Mm-hmm. Just
cool. One last comment, and then we'll move to the second case, if that's all right. Yeah, that's another good point, is that sort of the background conditions, it's not actually the drug company's fault that these companies are, that these countries are poor and that people there don't have access to healthcare. They didn't actually create, you know, they didn't actually, it's not the drug companies who, you know, were doing imperialism and all this kind of stuff. It's not necessarily fair to them either to say, well, actually it should be your job to fix the legacy of colonialism. That's kind of a big ask. So let's move on quickly to a second case. Again, pardon the alliteration, I can't help myself. So Pharmaco is at it again. They've developed now a Me Too drug for asthma. So there's already a lot of different drugs out there for asthma. They've developed another one, but they're worried that it's not going to be as good as the existing treatments, and so they won't be able to prove its efficacy, or they, you know, they might be able to prove its efficacy, but it's sort of iffy because they're not sure if it's going to actually pass the non-inferiority test to show that it's not worse than an existing treatment. And so they want to do a placebo trial instead because they're pretty confident it's better than nothing. It's maybe not as good as what's out there, but it's better than nothing. And so the a CRO in Peru has offered to conduct this test against placebo. And they're going to do the test in remote Amazonian villages that don't normally have access to Western medicine. And so the idea being that the standard of care in those villages is no treatment. And so it would not necessarily be unethical to conduct a placebo trial there. I can see some eyebrows raised already. So participants might get health benefits from participating in this trial. Certainly they'll see a doctor for the first time in their life, for many of them. And if the drug turns out to work, then those people who are there who have asthma will definitely get a benefit if it does work. Pharmaco's offered to pay to build new safe wells for the villages, which is a local, you know, major concern for them. And obviously the company stands to profit. There's a lot of people with asthma, and a lot of people with asthma in rich countries, and you can, in America, where you can sell direct to the consumer by TV commercials, it doesn't necessarily matter if your drug isn't better than the old ones, just so long as you have a flashy commercial that says it's this new drug, and so it's new, well, it must be better. So potentially, asthmatics in high-income countries stand to lose because the new drug is going to be more expensive and it might be worse. Even though it's better than nothing, it might actually be worse than what they were using before, even though it costs 10 times as much. So then, in this case, do we think that the trial is exploitive? Any hands? Yes, exploitive? A few? No, not exploitive? No hands other than this time, okay. And I'm guessing the rest of you are on the fence. So who do you think might be getting exploited then in this case?
I think it's two groups, actually.
The
Amazonian people and the people who are going to buy the new drug.
That's interesting. So you think that the people who are going to buy the new drug are being exploited, which is interesting because they're not actually involved in the interaction at all. They're in a different continent from this trial completely. So that's an interesting outcome if we were exploiting people that aren't even in the interaction.
It doesn't seem ethical to be putting a drug on the market that's worse and more expensive. That in itself is unethical.
You would think so. It happens. That happens perhaps a lot more than we would like to believe. Because patents expire, and so there's a lot of onus on drug companies to come up with new drugs, not necessarily because they're better than old drugs, but because they're different from the old drugs, and so therefore they're allowed to have a new patent. So they may even be a slightly modified version of the existing drug in order to sort of evergreen the patent, to make the patent continue for another 20 years, despite the fact that it may work as well as the old one because it's basically the same as the old one, but you get to keep your patent, that's probably a different can of worms.
2 points. First one is I would wonder whether the drug this study would be approved because it's not against the standard of care that's acceptable. So generally, you'd want to test against the gold standard. So this is against placebo. So I just wonder whether the regulatory process would allow for this study to go through anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Second question on that point about Me Too is going on the market. It happens in every industry as well. How many brands of peanut butter are there on the market? No one's better than any other. But they just, so it's a marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So
with regard to the second point, I mean, the difference being that we don't give patents for peanut butter. So
not patents, but people who develop these products to get part of a large market share.
Sure.
So as soon as there's a market share.
But the unique thing with the patent system is it's actually effectively a very strong public subsidy for these companies because they get to access to the resources of the state to police. To make sure that no one else is allowed to make and sell that product for 20 years, which allows them to charge whatever price they like. But
if it's a Me Too, the original's gone off patent around that time.
Yeah, so in the case of the Me Too, there's a patent on the new one. There's still the other treatment that's still available. But people do tend to have this perception that, well, if it's a new drug, it's obviously better, because why would they make a worse one? But it turns out they would, because the patent expires. So that's why they would make a worse one, because if they can, they can make more money. Well, I think I'm getting the signal that we're about out of time, so maybe there's one last question. Yeah, in practice, that's probably a concern. Let's imagine, for the sake of this example, that in this Amazonian village they have satellite TV and they all watch House every week. And so they have some idea of what these things are, even though they never have met a doctor. They, you know, they've got a lot of exposure to it, and they have so they have some knowledge, and it's all been translated into their language because you know, it's a philosophy example, so we're allowed to make up strange rules like that. last question in the back. Agreed. All right. Well, I think I'm definitely over time now. I can feel Paul's presence on the end of the room. So I think I'll say thanks very much for your questions and your participation.
Join me again in thanking Andrew for doing his job as a philosopher and leaving us with more questions than answers.
So just a couple of references here in case you're interested in exploitation theory. And then there's one more of...
There are, while we're going through the reference sites, there's some sandwiches and refreshments at the back door or at the front door and around the back. Sounds like I'm talking about my house, but there is... around the backyard with barbecue afterwards.
And then some more stuff about clinical trials, particularly in developing countries. I highly recommend the London and Zolman piece. That's quite good. It's accessible and interesting to read. So, not that the other ones aren't good, but they may share less in those particular two qualities.
It's a very Canadian way of describing it.
So, yeah, check this one out if you're going to only check out one, I would say.